You find it? It's on the very back, on the back back.
On the very back.
Yeah. There's a red, it's a silver button.
Is it?
Oh,
there is red in the middle.
There you go.
And
in the screen, does it have a red dot now?
It's on the left.
I wasn't sure. Is there a red dot up at the top?
Yeah, but I had to think of, like, the last king. I had to think of that. It's not obvious.
Good. Okay, we're in Matthew chapter 5. And,
where are we?
Matthew chapter 5. My page is 45 in your notes. Should be similar.
35.
C3?
Yes, ma'am. All right. Now, what we take for granted when it comes to things like what we're going to read in Matthew, we're revolutionary to the hearers. That's why they hung on every word. It is not the need of the hour to say something new, but it is the need of the hour to actually answer the confusion about truths that they knew from the Old Testament. Jesus never said one thing that wasn't already in the Old Testament. So that ought to be revolutionary to you. One is he didn't make up new doctrine. He actually brought out the light that was in the Old Testament. So when you come to here, and we're talking about salt, and we're talking about the effect of the followers of Jesus. Jesus is not talking about the effect of Israel on the world that had already become passé, that had already basically failed. And the Jews were not now being patted on the back saying, you had done a great job. No, he's saying, all right, I need you to follow me now so I can restore the depth and the riches of the Old Testament truths. So we're talking about salt, and we talked about the functions of the salt. Now, number three, there are dangers of becoming unsalty. So let's get into the Bible. Let's look at Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 13. We'll probably go back a little bit. Matthew 5. We'll start in verse 13. Ye are the salt of the earth. And he's speaking to his disciples, which were at that point counting in the thousands. He's talking to everybody. And he says, but if salt have lost his savor. Now, what does savor mean?
Taste.
It's taste. It's flavor. So imagine buying a container of salt from Tesco, and you begin to pour it on your egg, and you taste the egg, and it has no added flavor. So you pour more on, and there's no sharpness to the salt. Well, when you have salt that has lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? How do you salt salt? It is thenceforth, it is good for nothing. So that's where we get our phrase, good for nothing. But to be cast out and to be trodden under the foot of men, it's no good. Well, ye are the light of the world. What good is a light bulb that doesn't light? It's no good. But you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid, because they have lights in there at night. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick. And they give it light to all that are in the house. So let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and end up glorifying your Father which is in heaven. So he's talking about the effect of his followers. So there are dangers of becoming unsalty. We become ineffective. If you are unsalty, you're ineffective in the ministry. That's your fill-in there. Now, to be honest, I worry a lot about this. A pastor's not supposed to worry, but I do. I worry that I'll be ineffective in my ministry. The goal of a surgeon, the goal of a doctor is actually help people. But if a pastor and his preaching and his ministries aren't helping people, one thing to look at is his own saltiness, whether he has lost his savor. And it's very important, because the last thing any church needs is just a figurehead that just fulfills the role of a speaker at the front. So some people, if you are teaching Sunday school, if you're helping in a ministry or whatever, and you've lost your savor, that is the danger. There's no zing in your witnessing, no preaching, no zing in your praying. That ought to be a testimony to you. Say, Lord, help me get my saltiness back. B, we gain a damaged reputation if we lose our savor. Truth is, it's hard to reach people who have no respect for you. So if they met Joe Soap, Christian, and he's always angry, or you met Jane Soap, And she's just always panicking, always anxious. That gives a testimony to the world that Christ is ineffective. Now, I worry about this, and that is that we as Christians, we're great believing God as long as everything's stable. Is that true? But almost, and I'll be truthful with you, Jesus had at times, he had 10,000 people following him, and then there were times at the end where he had 12. And he even asked those 12, are you also going to go away? So what I worry about as a pastor, and I don't, this is not my main focus, but I do worry that Satan loves to hit the button that will cause you to quit. And he will do it. He knows what will trip you up, what will cause you to get angry at God, or to lose your savor, to lose that joy, to lose the power behind your Christianity. And the way he does that is he gets you where it hurts. So there are too many Christians who so easily can encourage other Christians, but when the trouble hits them, they collapse. And that's not Christianity. So Jesus is speaking to the disciples saying, guys, if you're really in on this thing, you can't stop shining. And people will sense a saltiness there. So he's actually establishing a standard by which we need to judge our lives and saying, am I bright? Do I have a flavor to the world, or am I just blah with everybody else? Let me run on down to number C. We tarnish the image of the church. For example, all I have to say is Catholic priests and small boys, because the image has been tarnished, hasn't it? All right? Well, because of the growing scandal in the Catholic Church, people have become distrusting of priests, most of whom would never do such a horrible thing. And yet, there is such a tarnish. Well, the Catholic Church will be dealing with this for the next century or better, until the Lord returns. But the truth is this, when Christians lose power, it affects our testimony to the world. They don't even know we're here. Does that grieve you? Christians used to step so differently. We walked and lived, and nobody... Listen, I'm not a head-covering person, which means that women have to wear head coverings. But I have no problem with it either, because it identified Christian ladies. People go, that's a Christian woman. Modest dress, the way people dress, the way people live, used to be clearly, that's a worldly person, that's a Christian. So... it is a worry, it is a concern about us losing our savor. So, number D, if a person becomes unsalty, they can become salty again. Aren't you glad for second chances? Aren't you glad for the grace of God? It's hard, but it's not impossible to restore the ministry of a person who's become unsalty. Yes, by repentance and restoration, but it's a lot easier. Here's the point. It's a lot easier to keep your ministry salting than it is to make salt less salty again. So, just that point. I just give you some thoughts on how to be salty later on. Number D, light. Matthew 5:14 says, you're the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill, here's your key word, cannot be hid. Doctrine referring to the Jews as a peculiar people. Isaiah 61 says, arise and shine, for thy light has come. So, Israel should have been shining with their Messiah. Their Messiah had come, and it should have made Israel just explode with light. Well, no, it didn't. They ended up killing him and ended up driving Christians out. But it expands to include the followers of Jesus that Jesus was drawing after him. Look at 1 Peter 2:9. 1 Peter 2:9. You're a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. All these things, you're a peculiar people. What does all that do for us? Well, that you would show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. So you should show forth, you should shine forth, you might say. So, number C, the whole world lies in darkness. They love darkness. They hate the light. But the only way for the world to know God is for them to see light. John the Baptist was a great example of light. Jesus even said he was a great and shining light. So light is illumination. It's not just truth, but it is the opening of blinded eyes to the truth. Even Paul says this, that Jesus called him to open people's eyes. So we are the light of the world. Verse 15 says, neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick. And it giveth light unto all that are in the house. So don't hide your Christian life. You ought to be completely unashamed. Isn't it funny? What are most people today unashamed of? I'm talking about anybody and everybody. What are they most unashamed of? Okay, their sin. That's a good truth. Let's be a little more specific. I mean, there are women who are very unashamed of their bodies, which is something, when I was growing up, it was something, you weren't ashamed of it, but you were ashamed of people flaunting it. What else are people unashamed of?
Filthiness.
Okay, their language. Isn't that funny? I mean, we could probably go and list maybe 10 things that people are unashamed of. Their sexuality. They're unashamed of their anger.
Drunkenness.
What's that?
Drunkenness.
Honestly, when you start to think about it, wow, all of a sudden you start to remember, yeah, that's almost gone. Shame is almost gone. Except in Christians, we're ashamed of our difference. We're ashamed of the fact that we are standing different than the world. We're ashamed of the gospel, how offensive it is to a world that believes they're good. I was reading an article by a very angry atheist Jew who was furious at Christians constantly giving them the gospel. And he's just furious that they had no shame to come right up to him, knowing that he was a Jew, and telling him, you need to be born again. He was furious at it. And I just, one of these days he's going to stand before God, and God says, that was my love. That was my kindness towards you. But we're afraid to go up to somebody. This guy was saying that these Christians are saying that all these people are no good, which is an extreme statement. We're saying we're not good enough. But wow, it's just, we don't want to offend anybody. We don't want to get in trouble. So, light, when he talks about the light, he says, don't hide your Christian life. It ought to affect your home, most definitely. They ought to see your light, verse 3. Verse 16 says, let your light so shine before men. Let them see your good works. So, number 3. Then he moves on to teaching on the importance of the law. Verse 17, chapter 5, 17. He goes on and says, think not that I am come to destroy the law. Now, that's a very important statement, because what was it that the Pharisees were afraid of with Jesus? Not just breaking the law, but replacing the law, doing away with the law. They accused him of it. They accused Paul of it. So their idea was that anybody who came along and would say one thing against the law, they were a heretic and they were to be stoned. So Jesus says, don't think. And a lot of people were glad, looking forward to somebody to throw away the law. A lot of people want to do as they please. But verse 17 says, think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I'm not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth shall pass, not one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say unto you, that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. So number 3, he's teaching on the importance of the law. I want to say that the law, the Old Testament, consisted of two parts. The first one we call the law, and the second one's called the prophets. The law and the prophets. But one part needed to complete it, and that was the gospel. The gospel fulfills both the law and the prophets for the believer. Now, there were many people who talked about destroying the law and even overturning the prophets and rejecting them. Jesus said he had come to do the impossible. What was impossible about the law and the prophets? To fulfill them. Nobody could fulfill all of the prophecies. Even if you tried, you couldn't make them come to pass. Maybe a few of them you could force. But he's going to fulfill not only the prophets, but the law. So he's going to fulfill the righteousness of the law, and he's going to fulfill all the prophecies of the prophets, especially concerning himself. Now, God's law was not and is not frivolous. It is the foundation for grace in the gospel. So let me say that again. The very foundation of the gospel is what? Well, no, Jesus is the gospel. His life, his death, his burial, resurrection. But the gospel is built upon what? The law. Okay? The law is a fixed, unchanging absolute. And Jesus is saying, we don't want to get rid of that any more than you want to get rid of the foundation on a house. So the foundation of the law, and we'll also add the prophets, all were pointing to the gospel, and the gospel is built upon them. The gospel doesn't just come along like the Mormons come along and throw it all away and create this new, nice, tidy little new religion. Number E, there are three. Now, I'm going to throw some more confusion into you, but there are three classifications of Moses' law. Okay, three classifications is very important for you to know. All right, so there are three groups or classifications of the law. I'm talking about Moses' law. Number one, civil law. Civil laws. What were those?
Between people, you know.
Partially. That's very good. Good. All right. Well, no. It's not just that. Civil law means governing laws. Laws on how to govern people. On how communities operate. Rules. And like, for example, if your neighbor's cow falls into your field, and you're responsible for that cow now. And you're supposed to get it up and take it back to your neighbor. Those are right kind of laws. Number two, there are civil laws. There are moral laws. Now, what are moral laws? Okay. They are absolute, and they are a definition of what's right and wrong. Okay. And then there's a third one. The third classification of laws is ceremonial laws. And we can write that that's how you worship God. Okay. So when Jesus, look, civil laws are still right to base all laws, every government would do well to base all of the laws of people on God's laws in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Moral laws, unchangeable. They are absolute. They will never change. World without end. But ceremonial laws, using a priesthood in a temple, in Jerusalem, a lamb, turtle doves, a basket of flour, all of these offerings and the feasts and all that stuff were all part of the ceremonial laws. So when the Old Testament ended and the New Testament began, which one of these laws were done away with? Actually. Which part of the laws? Were the moral laws done away with at the cross? No. We're civil laws. Now, there are some things that are specifically to Israel that cannot be operated in a democratic society. It was a theocracy. You couldn't blaspheme God. There were civil laws that were actually related to the ceremonial laws. But the moral laws did not die. The civil laws, I would say there are some discrepancies about how far you can take them. But all of the ceremonial laws died on the cross with Jesus. There's no more priesthood because Jesus is the high priest. He's the end of all of the Old Testament ceremonies, all pointed to one final lamb, one high priest, so on and so forth. So,
so when he says, I came to fulfill the law, that's part of the
He's doing more than I can probably say effectively. I apologize, let me get to my point. He fulfilled all the requirements of obedience to all the Old Testament laws in relating to an individual Jew. He was willing to do, and he yielded to everybody in authority. A centurion called for Jesus, and when Jesus got nearby, he says, don't come under the roof of my house. I'm not worthy for you to be here. I just need you to speak the word because I am a man under authority also. And he knew that with Jesus, he was operating not in rebellion, not as a rebel, not as somebody who wants to overthrow seditious reacts toward the government. He was somebody under authority. And he operated under every civil law, and he fulfilled all of the requirements of perfect living under even foreign law. He also fulfilled all the expectations of the moral law. Every expectation of the law for you to be able to call yourself righteous, he could do it, right? And he fulfilled all the ceremonies, everything that is required of a sacrifice, everything of the priest offering a sacrifice. Everything was done, and he fulfilled them all, which is breathtaking. Because I struggle just doing this one, all right? But he fulfilled all of them. Let's see. Beyond the Ten Commandments, there are 613 total laws in the Old Testament. How would you like to keep track of all them babies? All right. Now, some of them were kind of, you know, very specific to the Levites. So just giving you some background on some of that stuff. Now, anybody know what a jot or a tittle is? More than a little, but you're exactly right.
One's the smallest letter, isn't it?
All right. Well, now, you don't know what that is until I put a jot and a tittle on there. That's a jot. And that's a tittle. Okay?
I suppose it's like putting the leg. You have a P, and if you put a leg, it makes it an R. Would that be like a tittle?
Exactly. But it is the dot on an I and a cross on a T. And Jesus is saying that you don't know what that is until you put it, oh, it's an I, you know, it's an L. And over here, now we got a little thing over there, is that an L? Not until it's a T. And that one letter, it, has both a jot and a tittle in it. And Jesus is saying throughout all of the instructions, and that also shows the how perfect God was promising still to preserve his word, that there was still going to be jots and tittles, not just the general meaning, but every last dot and cross T was going to be preserved in the copy of the scriptures. So Jesus says, and this is another point, Allison. If you have a word, especially in Hebrew, sometimes they would have a letter look like this, okay, and that's one letter. That is another letter, just a jot in it made the letter a different letter. I know Hebrew. John would be the one to talk to you about Hebrew. All right? A tittle would be something like this and then that. So without it is one letter, and with that is another letter. And the point being that Jesus is not expecting and was promising that not one jot or one tittle of the Old Testament would disappear. You could always find an accurate copy of the Old Testament, especially the law and the prophets. Now, I want you to see that Jesus equated his words with the permanence of God's law. I want you to see, this is crazy. Verse 18, for verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Who's trying to fulfill it? Jesus was. And he's trying to say that he's related to the law. Go to Matthew 24:35. And he sneaks in a great truth. Matthew 24:35. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but God's words shall not pass away. So his words are equal to God's words. All right? So we go on.
What kind of heaven is he talking about?
Oh, our heaven, our universe. Now, you can't do away with God's heaven. Okay? So if you draw three circles, two of them will disappear one day and be replaced. Revelation chapter 21 says, the earth, surrounded by a bit of atmosphere, that's the first heaven. Okay? Then the universe, the stars and everything else and all the galaxies, that's the second heaven. Here's number one, two. And where God is number three. Now, when the Bible says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, God's heaven already existed. He created us inside him. That's the wild thing.
Isn't that what in 1 John, didn't he say he went to the third heaven?
No, it's 1 John, but you're thinking of Paul. He's talking about going to the third heaven and seeing things that he was not allowed to tell about until John, the Apostle John, went there. So the idea is, I saw a new heaven and a new earth. Not a new place where God lives. Okay.
So will all the planets and stars be disappeared and remade?
Burned up.
So everything out there that we know
will be replaced.
Yeah, it's a good thing we don't do it.
So can you imagine if we had to live in this toxic world for 1,000 years with all the or for millions and billions of years? No, he's going to burn all that up and replace with a new heaven, a new earth. Okay? Okay, we go on. Now, he says something very amazing. He says there in verse 19, he says, whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and teach others also, what will they be?
Least in the kingdom.
Ah, so here's Joe Jew, all right? Here's JJ, all right? And Jesus is describing moving from where he is to another level, and the new level is the kingdom of heaven. He's talking about the kingdom they're all wanting to have. All right? And JJ can be least in the kingdom if he teaches wrong doctrine and yet is saved. He says, whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments, you're not going to break any of them and get away with it, but shall teach men so he shall be called the least. He's not lost. He just has no reward in the kingdom of heaven. He's least in the kingdom of heaven, but whosoever shall live by the law and teach others also and teach the laws, the same shall be called great. So he has the opportunity to be at a level that is greatly honored in now the kingdom of heaven. For simplicity, is the millennium. The millennial reign of Jesus, when is that? In the future. That's 1,000-year reign after the tribulation. So he's actually pointing to events way off in history, and he's saying, I don't want anybody thinking that they can just break God's laws. Now, you can follow me, because he's talking to followers, and not lose your salvation, but you get no reward in the millennium. I want you to go to Romans chapter 8. Now, I kind of blew your mind. Romans chapter 8. And Paul says this. Verse 16. The Spirit itself beareth witness with our spirit that we are the children of God. So there's a voice inside of you that says, you're in. And if we're children, then we are heirs. Heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. But he puts a condition on it. If so be, now we're talking about Christians, but you are an heir. Now this is when we get our inheritance. Everybody looking up here real quick. This is our inheritance in the future. This is where Jesus promises that people who follow him and suffer will reign with him in the millennium. And he says, but you'll only reign if in this life, you're a believer, yes, but you suffer. If so be that we suffer with him, you're persecuted, you're hated, that we may also be glorified together. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. So there's a lot there, but I just want you to see that Jesus is speaking of a future kingdom, and we're still looking forward to it. But he's speaking to people who already are believers. They're already following him. At least that's the goal. Number four, teaching on anger. Isn't that an important subject to teach? Huh? I should be on the next main point. Number four, teaching on anger. Verse 21. You have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment, and whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council, and whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing. So the seventh commandment, Jesus begins to deal with misconceptions about the commandments and the law. And the first commandment he deals with is thou shalt not kill. Now, that's pretty clear, but he's dealing with premeditated murder out of anger. Thou shalt not kill. Now, if you accidentally killed somebody, now that's kind of, you know, it's a horrible thought. But if you accidentally kill somebody, what is that called?
Manslaughter.
Okay. And now, that is not murder, though, is it? When does the death that you cause become murder? Okay. When you have a, when they notice a motive, and your motive is, I wanted to kill them. All right, so that's where Jesus says, thou shalt not kill. And he's not dealing with the act. What is he dealing with? The heart. So everyone, from now on, from this point on, chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 7, guess what Jesus is going to expose in every one of the laws?
Our heart.
And why we do and why we don't do things. So, and by the way, if you happen to kill out of self-defense, it's not murder either. It's just self-defense. Now, there was a serious penalty for murder. What was that?
Death.
It was death. Now, they got rid of it in most of the rest of the world. They think that they've done the world a favor. And yet, murders continue to go through the roof. Whereas 50 years ago, you had... In Ireland, when we came here 24 years ago, there was one murder a year. What was it like in Northern Ireland? Maybe it was a little more... aggravated. I don't know, because of the troubles up there, you couldn't count. But if you didn't have the troubles, I wonder how many murders there would have been. I bet very few. But because of our overturning of the concept of the sanctity of life and our concept of, listen, you kill, you will be killed. That's a great deterrent. But when they got away with that and they coddled all of people's, we understand why you're angry and nobody should ever be forced to forgive, all this stuff, because they've taught all of these things for the last 50 years. We have murder through the roof in all the charts, whereas Jesus deals with, you know, the act is because of the heart. Let's look at the heart. Murder is a result, and you need to mark this, murder is a result of anger in the heart. Okay, that is a big thing. Don't wait until you kill before you recognize the problem in your heart.
Is that down here? Or we just write
is it not there on number 4C?
Virtual murder.
Oh, I haven't gotten down there. I must have extra things. I'm sorry.
Okay, murder.
But I want you to write this down. Murder is a result of anger in the heart. Now, I'll say this. Some people have different... They have their own conclusions about anger. I'll say anger is usually a sin. It's not always a sin. Jesus got angry. Paul got angry. Anger can be justified. The Bible says that if you're angry without a cause, in verse 22, Did you notice, maybe I should bring in some of the new Bibles so that you can get a good view of this. In almost all of the new Bibles, they take out the words without a cause.
Yeah, they do. It's not here. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment.
As if to say, if you're ever angry, you're going to have judgment. No. There are times, if you have a cause, it's okay and it's right to be angry. It is not right to stay angry. How long can you let your anger last?
Till sundown.
Till sundown. By the end of the day, it has to be fixed. But it is okay to just say, that's it, I'm fed up, you're in trouble. And you're not allowed to be angry. Don't even push me. So, if you have a good reason, a cause, anger is acceptable in short duration. Question, did David have a cause to kill Goliath? Yes or no?
Yeah.
And yet the Bible says, I shall not kill. No, he had a good cause. So, in the coming kingdom, if you're angry for the wrong reasons, you're going to face judgments. Obviously, murderers are going to be facing judgment. Virtual murder, anger, is just as bad. What was the problem between Cain and Abel? It was actually envy, yes. But it said, God asked Cain, doest thou well to be angry? See, the problem wasn't murder. The problem was he was angry. And his anger was based on envy. You see how that process snowballs? In any counselor, you ever deal with people, take somebody who's got a problem and go as far back as you can, not into repressive memories, but go back as far as you can to bad habits. Here's Joe Christian. And you want to go back and say they're full of, right now they're full of anger. They're full of bitterness. They're full of hatred. They just can't stand the presence of somebody. Whatever you want to list. You don't want to just go back to an event. Well, they said so-and-so. They did so-and-so. No, you're going to have to go back behind that and find out what caused your heart to react to that event with anger. Because all of us have events. And it's not the event that we have to worry about. It's our heart that we have to worry about. So every counselor, whether they know it or not, knows that they've got to go, all right, here's a marriage counselor and talking between two people. And why are you upset? That's how you start counseling. Why are you upset? And all the, well, he did this, he won't do that, he doesn't come home on time, and he won't do it. Right, those are all events. But you've got to go back and say, why is your heart so angry? Why is your heart angry? Well, because of, no. There's something else. That's why you go back and you say, maybe you're talking about a woman, maybe her dad never was home, maybe her brothers, you know, we're just constantly rude, so anytime her husband mistreats her, she imagines and remembers her brother's mistreatment. You have no idea, but that is where the heart was defiled.
But sometimes, you don't always, I know you still go back to the heart, but sometimes it's the event that causes your heart to bring out that anger, bitterness, and hatred. So you don't sometimes have the look before the event, because you can say that's where that started.
I'm not going to say that it doesn't start here, but I'm going to say Jesus says you cannot control the event. You're going to have to find out why your heart is prone to becoming angry at the event continuously. You may get angry, but if you're continually angry, and I don't want to teach you counseling, and I apologize for going too deep on this, but I think it's very important as a Christian to realize Jesus wasn't dealing with the problem of murder in society. He was dealing with the problem of the heart that resulted in murder. And what causes the heart to want to kill someone? A heart that had no hope. And says the only justice is if I put it in my own hands. So that's how come you go back to, let's look at your heart. Let's look at your heart. Because that's, if you fix the heart, whether you get justice or not, you can be free. But if you have to fix justice and you don't fix the heart, that person will never be free. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you'll continue on with the bitterness.
Yes, ma'am. So I'm just showing you this was revolutionary to the audience because they had heard if somebody did such and such, you deal with them back. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now that kept society really stable because you just didn't argue with one another or else you're going to be brought before the law. So let's see. He goes on and he says, name calling will face councils. Raca is the Hebrew word for vain fellow. We'd say you're an airhead or you're a dope. That's what we used to say. Dimwit. Well, if you did that, you go before a council and they go, what's in your heart? Why are you doing that? And that's what your parents were supposed to do. Your parents, if you are name calling your brother, oh man, there's some cruel things you can call your family. Remember that? Now, my family never did, but I heard a family, you're adopted. Oh, man. Can you imagine growing up in a home where one of your older brothers says, you don't even belong in this family, you're adopted. Can you imagine the hurt of that? That was the job of the parents. Say, whoa, you're going to deal with me now. That's a council. That's the effect of it. So don't be calling each other names, or you may have to appear before a council to explain yourself, and you will be punished. To call someone a fool is to judge them as a child of the devil. That's what a fool is. Again, if you go around and say you're a fool, you're actually calling somebody an unbeliever. And you got to be careful. The fool says in his heart there's no God. And the issue is not name-calling, but the fact that people accuse without a cause. They just go around. And listen, if somebody is a fool, if somebody like Peter Hitchens and like Richard Dawkins up there, and they say, it is stupid to believe in any kind of deity, stupid to believe in God. He's a fool, all right? I can call him a fool because there's good cause. I don't want to call him a fool because I don't want him to go to hell, but he is a fool. So Jesus is talking about calling people names without a proof and without a cause. And this was Jesus taking a law and saying, look, there's a law against you killing, but I want you to live by a higher law, and that is you shouldn't be name calling David. Wow, is that powerful? All of a sudden Christians have a tenderness toward each other, and they have a responsibility to I don't have the cross reference here, but what does it say, Darren, when Jesus, Paul says, let no corrupt communication proceed out of the mouth, but what? Do you remember? But that which edifies. It's revolutionary. Christians should be the most bright, shining people in the planet because we don't call each other names. Just that one thing is breathtaking to me. All right, we got to rush. The truth is, number five, you cannot worship God in anger. Verse 23 says, if you're angry at your brother, or, this is the harder part, Darren, then if you know your brother's angry at you. I'm on number five.
Teaching on blank and blank.
Oh, I hate that. Go back to
27, 30.
Where are you?
Page 37.
Yep, I'm not there. I want to talk about that point for a minute. Let me just say that you cannot worship God in anger. You really can't. You can't have somebody angry at you, and you can't be angry at somebody.
Yeah, but even that verse in 23, if you remember that thy brother has aught against thee, like, it's not that I have something against.
No, nope, it's if say somebody else in church got offended at you and is angry at you and won't come to church now. Now, there's time when you don't know it. All of a sudden, word gets to you, so-and-so was really upset at the way you said something to them. You can't just, like the Westerners, you can't just brush it off. Well, they can get over it. No. You want to worship God? You want to honor God? You put that, whatever you're doing, down, and you go to them and say, how do I make this right? That's double responsibility than what we're used to. It should be the person who hurt me, they should come to me. Bingo.
It's hard.
It is hard. Okay. So you can't. I read this. A Christian cannot be an enemy of any man. A Christian cannot be the enemy of anybody. Without the fullest of evidence, you always have to give people the benefit of the doubt. So listen, I mean, if there's a rapist in our neighborhood, I'm his enemy, okay? But most people, I cannot be the enemy of them. God will not accept the worship of an angry man. That is rough. Guess how many normal men throughout history, what type of attitude mankind has had. I'm dealing with men. Don't talk about women because they're a different kind of fish. Men generally have been angry throughout history. Very poor worshipers because they're angry. And Jesus says, you don't know how to worship God that way. You can't worship that God, or worship God that way. Now, I want to just say most anger comes from an offense, but that offense is no justification for staying angry. In Christ's kingdom, you know what Christ's kingdom is built upon? Faith and love. That's what Christ's kingdom is built upon. It's not built upon anger and rightness. Right? So, resolve things quickly. Listen to one another. Learn from each other. Agree with your adversary before they take you to court. Or else, you know what Jesus says? I'm not going to help you. Jesus promises that if you won't make things right and your adversary, the person who's angry at you, takes you to court, don't you pray and ask God to deliver you, because I'm going to let you go to jail if you won't do right. Isn't that strong? All right, now, the next one. Teaching on adultery and lust. Teaching on adultery and lust, 27. This is what we're going to learn next year, by the way. We're actually going through the kingdom of God all next year. And so right now I'm giving you some taste of some things of what we're going to actually spend a lot of time on during all of next year. Verse 27, he says, ye have heard that it was said of them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. Where'd you get that from? That's the seventh commandment. Verse 28, but I say unto you, all right, that's okay, good. But whosoever, God bless you, looks on a woman to lust after her. Now, it's not wrong to look at a woman. Don't look, honey. Whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if thy right eye offend thee, if your right eye is constantly glancing at women, constantly causing you to undress them, constantly causing you to commit adultery, pluck it out, man. Cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offend thee, say you're a kleptomaniac, say you just get always breaking God's laws with your hand, cut it off, cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. I think Jesus is always using extremes. That if something is stopping you from following him, stopping you from getting saved, stopping you from doing right, cut it off. I'll give you a very extreme example. About 2 years ago, you might remember a climber over, I think it was the Rocky Mountains somewhere. He was rock climbing. They made a movie about it, evidently. He was climbing up some mountain, and the side of the mountain shifted and fell and crushed his right or left arm. And he was trapped there for 2 days. He couldn't get out. He was bleeding to death, and he was getting an infection in the arm. And he was up in the middle of nowhere, he didn't have a phone, no nothing, and his arm was already dead, and he cut it off with his own knife and tourniqueted and walked to safety. And the principle is, you either stay there because you love your arm, or you cut it off and you live. Now that's an extreme, and that's a modern day event, but if somebody, and this is the truth, that if somebody, if it's going to cost you your friends to get saved, lose your friends. If it's going to cost you your family to follow Christ, lose your family. That sound like the worst contradiction. But Jesus goes beyond losing family. He says losing an arm, losing an eye. So he uses an extreme so that we can apply it to everything. Up to the extreme. He doesn't say that you hopefully will ever experience where you have to pluck out your eye. But you ought to be willing to lose whatever is stopping you from following him. Okay? Let's see. Adultery is obviously very wicked, and yet it is the main thought process going on in Western society today. I don't think that I don't think it's possible that people go very far or very long. I'm talking about Christians, that Christians go very long without committing adultery on a regular basis. When we stand before the judgment seat of Christ, we're going to be ashamed of how much our minds have wandered, how much images have been played in our heads without us even wanting them. The act of adultery is not what this commandment is focusing on. When it says, thou shalt not commit adultery, it's about lusting after women in your heart. So the lust of someone is the heart of someone. So if you're going to commit adultery, what are some conditions that have to be met? One of those two is married. Right? One of them is married. That's adultery is an act of violating a marriage vow. There's two. It says, hath committed adultery in his heart with her. So two tango. It's awfully hard to commit adultery with a modest looking woman in your heart. It really is. But a woman who doesn't care how she dresses actually can be encouraging that. Now, there's no excuse for the man, but we sort of, in our modern age, we're not allowed to point out that a woman is dressed immodestly. Oh, the men, they should be able to get over it. A woman needs to know it's not so easy. It takes two to tango. He says, with her in his heart. Other conditions that have to be met, okay? This thing of lusting, This lust is a desire to have. And when Jesus is talking about this thing, he's talking about a very, very secret, something that people would never, ever admit to. And yet he's exposing it, saying, you know, you guys are worried about being caught committing adultery, but I'm telling you, you need to catch yourself in your thought life about what you want. Because adultery does not begin in bed. It begins in the heart. Some of the things that I listed that causes adultery is lust. An intense and wrong desire for something that you cannot have. That's what I should have said. Eyes cause adultery. Look at 1 Peter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 14. First Peter 2:14 talks about verse 11. Did I say 2:14? It should be 2:14. It is.
2:11.
No, I'm going to go back. Starting verse 11. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly, keyword, lusts, which war against the soul, having your conversation honest with among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. I'm looking for the verse. Maybe it's 2 Peter 2.
Yeah.
2:14. Ah, okay. So these are wicked people having eyes full of adultery, full of TV. And they cannot cease from sin. And they go out and they beguile, they lure unstable souls and heart they have exercised with covetous practice. And they have cursed children. Their families are cursed. So, number F, if anything is causing you to sin against God, God's laws, then cut it off. Now, I'm going to go ahead and try to get divorce out of the way. I shouldn't. But what did it, okay, what does it say? What does the word, the phrase say? Oh, you don't have an F. If anything causes you to sin against God's laws, is that what you have?
D. Mm-hmm. That's our D.
Yes, okay. Then that was my F, sorry. So, I'll have to stop because we'll have to deal with, and I'm sure we'll have some questions on divorce next week.
So is that still on divorce?
The next one, number 7, is teaching on divorce, yes.